This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Trainer Todd Pletcher has reached the stratosphere.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Moon over Miami for Bill Mott.
3,000 for trainer Mark Cassie.
Trainer D-Way Lucas, a 6th win.
And Bob Baffert with another incredible milestone.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Win number 1,000 for the great Trevor McCarthy.
Here's 2,000 for Nick Zito.
Steve Aspison is now North America's all-time leading trainer.
Now here's Mike Pena.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to a Breeders' Cup Week edition of Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, with you for the next hour. This is indeed the show trainers listen to, and you are listening all across North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, and streaming live or podcasting the show on our HRRN website at horseracingradio.net. Well, today's guest is quickly closing in on 1,900 career victories. His runners have earned more than $34 million in purses, but as we approach the 38th Breeders' Cup World Championships, the 65-year-old who was born in Lakeland, Florida, is preparing to saddle his very first starter in those championship races. And let me tell you, folks, he ain't messing around. The first time he walks into a Breeders' Cup paddock, it will be for the $6 million Breeders' Cup Classic on Saturday afternoon, and he will be accompanied by his talented 3-year-old gelding, Stiletto Boy, who figures to light up the tote board if he can pull off the upset at Old Del Mar this weekend. But as you'll hear, pulling off big upsets in Grade 1 races really is nothing new for today's trainer. Please join me in welcoming trainer Ed Mosier Jr. to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Ed, appreciate the visit today.
Good morning.
I mentioned, some of those accolades, and we're going to talk about some of the special moments in your career as we move throughout the hour here. But sitting here just a few days away from the Breeders' Cup World Championships, your first starter, and it comes in the $6 million Breeders' Cup Classic. Just put it into words. What's it like right now for you?
Well, it's the biggest – obviously the biggest purse I've ever ran for. I've always wanted to run in the Breeders' Cup or a classic race. And, we had a chance here a few years ago with Stormy Lucy. She was on the also eligibles and we didn't, we were really excited to get in, but we were stuck on the also eligibles and didn't get in. But, so I'm real excited.
Do you even let yourself think ahead to Saturday afternoon and what it might be like if Stiletto Boy finds a way to cross the finish line first?
My whole life I've always dreamed of winning every race that I run in, but to me it's like, I know it's a big purse. And I've ran a lot of races, like we've won almost 1,900 races, and it's a really, really big race, but the purse isn't that big a deal. It's the event, more than it is the purse.
Yeah. As you were saying that, I was thinking about like the Super Bowl in football, and people will say, well, it's just another game. You have to approach it like it's just another football game, but it's really hard to do if you're involved in that particular game. Is it like that now for you too? You try to say, hey, it's just another horse race, but man, it's the Breeders' Cup Classic, so can you really look at it in that light?
I mean, my brother and I were both like really excited. I mean, we're talking every day about it, so yeah, it's definitely definitely a bigger race than an average race, but I've visioned the race. I can see us win the race. I have a lot of horses. This horse is so good right now, and I keep telling my brother, I said, we got one more work. I mean, just hopefully it keeps just going as good as it's going right now. And that horse is as good as he can be right now. That's the way it is. And I don't say that about a lot of horses. And he's, like, really good right now. And Candace Rumble, he's real excited about riding him. He thinks he'll have no trouble doing the a mile and a quarter. And, you know, we've kind of known which horses are going to be in there the whole time. And obviously super, super tough horses. And they've done way more than what my horse has done. But our horse is, like, coming to his best race, and you never know what happens. I could see him win. I could see it. The horse is really, really good right now.
Yeah, you mentioned that he has that one more work before he'll go to the post in the Breeders' Cup Classic. As folks are listening to this now a couple days before the race, he has had that one work, because we are recording this a bit early, that work coming on Tuesday of Breeders' Cup week for Stiletto Boy. Look, if he's going to win the Breeders' Cup Classic, first of all, he's going to have to make up five lengths on Medina Spirit, who beat him in the Grade 1 Awesome Again last time out. But I can imagine, Ed, that you had to be very proud of the way that Stiletto Boy performed in that race.
I was really proud because I know, like, the Medina Spirit ran awesome. I mean, he's obviously a really, really good horse, but the horses that ran behind us were really, really good horses, too. You know, it's not like there's one good horse in there, and we didn't beat him. He actually beat, you know, really, really good horses that were behind him. So I think three of those are going to be in the Classic also.
What would you say, and the game's going to change a little bit, because the Awesome Again Stakes was a mile and an eighth. The Classic is a mile and a quarter. That changes the whole game. What would you say would be the one or two keys to victory for Stiletto Boy?
You know, he's number one. He's going to have to run probably faster than he's ever ran. I think the thing that may be able to help in the mile and a quarter, looks like there's going to be a lot of speed. And Medina Spirit got a pretty easy lead the other day. I think they went 24-48 or something like that. But, you know, there's going to be a lot of speed in the Classic. And it might set up really good for Stiletto Boy. He's actually got a lot of speed, but we've just been trying to rate him off the pace. And so it's not like they're going to be able to run away from him. You know, he's got a lot of speed. And we could probably put him on the lead if we wanted to. But we're going to actually try to, you know, do the same thing we've been doing, just try and get him to relax. And, you know, hopefully they'll go real fast up front and might set up good for us.
Yeah, and if nothing else, he is extremely versatile. You see his wins in, say, the Grade 3 La Jolla Del Mar on the turf, where he went, he didn't win that race, but he was on the lead that day and came up a little bit short where he got tired at the end. But his Iowa Derby effort in July, he went wire to wire to win that race. And now, as you said, you're teaching him to rate off the pace a little bit and then finish. And that seems to be a good strategy for him, too. And it might be the winning formula coming up in the Breeders' Cup Classic.
Yeah, we took him off, took blinkers off of him for his last two races, and that's why he's relaxing more. The first time we ran him, he was actually on the lead, and he was like almost like running off on the front end, you know. So we took him off just to take a chance and see if that would be better, and I think it helped a lot.
Talking with trainer Ed Mosher Jr. here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Stiletto Boy going in the Breeders' Cup Classic, taking on the top horses in the country. But he's done that. He's run against Medina Spirit his last two races, and he'll try to turn the tables on that rival and everybody else in that $6 million race. Ed, you talked about your brother, Steve Mosher, who is the owner of Stiletto Boy. He hasn't owned this horse from the beginning. He just purchased him at the Phasic Tipton sale in July, their Horses of Racing Age sale. He wasn't even at the sale when he bought him. I think that story is really cool, too. So tell me more about that.
Well, he bought it with Alistair Roden from Kentucky. He's a bloodstock agent. He was trying to find horses for my brother. And we've been trying to buy horses, you know. My brother always wants to get a good horse. He actually thought he had a deal with Exaggerator, you know, a few years ago before he even won the Santa Anita Derby. And the thing fell through, and, you know, he ended up, you know, what he ended up doing. But so my brother kept trying to buy, like, a really good horse. And you know, it's, you know, like, you know, it's really, really hard to do. If it was only, if it only took money, everybody would do it.
But, yeah.
Anyway, so he called me that afternoon and said, I got a horse for you. He said, a horse just won the Iowa Derby. And I said, oh, really? And to me, I've never even told my brother this, but I think the reason he didn't tell me he was buying it, because he knew I would tell him, no, don't buy it. So I think that's the way that, I mean, I've never really asked him that, but that's probably what it was, because we turned down a lot of horses. We went back to New York to look at two horses for a lot of money, and I turned down both of them and came back home, and they were like $600,000, and neither one were very good, and neither one ever ran again after that. So it was a good thing we didn't buy them. But yeah, so anyway, he bought that horse, and I would, even after he bought it, I was still real leery whether he's going to be able to compete in California. You know, he won an Iowa Derby. I mean, he ran great, but, you know, right before that, he was like a nominal to two. And so he went from there to, you know, to come to California and running great at stake. It's like a tough thing to do. And he's only three on top of it. And so I probably would have told him that's too much money for that horse, I would imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it turned out to be a brilliant decision on his part, and it just goes to show you that two heads are better than one, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they're two heads and leave me out.
Exactly. Well, hey, I'm sure you've made a lot of right decisions in your training career too. This happened to be one that, you know, fell on the other side of the fence, and that's fine, because you'd love to be wrong with this one coming up in the Breeders' Cup Classic, wouldn't you?
Yes.
That would be spectacular.
Doesn't bother me at all.
Yeah, no, you'll gladly be wrong. Ed Mosier Jr. here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. I mentioned that your brother wasn't even at the sale. Fasig Tipton launched online bidding during the pandemic in 2020, and that continued into this year. And he was sitting at home in Washington State bidding remotely and ends up getting Stiletto Boy, which I think is another cool angle to the whole story.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I'm pretty sure he did the bidding himself, too. I don't think he had the bloodstock agent do it. I think he did it on his own, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, great stuff. And to be here with your brother now and to be running your first Breeders' Cup starter in a race like the Classic and do it with your brother, that has to be pretty special, too, Ed.
Oh, yeah. And I'm really excited. I think my brother's even more excited.
How did your brother get into racing?
Oh, him and I used to, well, he's 7 years younger than me, but we used to go to Long Acres. Actually, he went when he was real young, because I was like 18 and 19, so I guess he was 12. And he'd go around and pick up losing tickets, and then he'd sit in and take the program and look to him. He won like every day at the races and never lost, because he'd just find losing tickets. And he always like cash in, you know, a couple of show bets and stuff. But anyway, we liked the races, you know, right from day one. And, you know, I started training when I was 19 years old. And so my brother actually worked for me in the summers, you know, when he was at school. And I'd give him $10 a day.
Wow. Did he ever think of becoming a trainer too?
I don't think he liked $10 a day. I think he was looking to make more money than that.
Well, I can't blame him on that one.
No, he's never wanted to train horses, but he loves the game, always has.
What's he do for work now?
He doesn't do anything now. He had his own company, and he sold it maybe like 10 or 12 years ago.
Well, it would be wonderful to see the two of you standing next to each other in the winner's circle. And I mentioned in my introduction that you are no stranger to pulling off an upset in a grade one race. And that's because of the fact that you did it years ago, just a few years ago, as a matter of fact, in the grade one matriarch. That was in 2015 with Stormy Lucy, who, by the way, owned by your brother, Steve, won at odds of 65-1 that day. Kent DeSormo was aboard. He'll be aboard Stiletto Boy. There's a lot of similarities there, Ed.
Yeah, it's kind of weird the way that turned out. But, yeah, you know, Stormy Lucy was a really, really good horse. And she won the Matriarch, and then she actually, her next three races, she got to be like ahead in each race. And they were all graded stakes. And then she actually had like a throat problem. That's why we retired her. And we put her through the sale in Kentucky. I think he got like $550,000 for her, but we paid $500,000 for her when she was younger.
Well, and then she becomes that grade one winner, so she becomes worth more automatically when she crosses the finish line that day. Talk about that side of the training business, Ed. When you have a talented filly or a talented mare like you did, how important is it to get them grade one status? Forget about winning, but just to get them grade one placed.
Fillies is real important. If you win a grade one, especially if it's a young horse, they're automatically worth like around $1 million. So that's probably more important than if you there's a lot of mares and there's not that many stallions, so you win with a great stake with a stallion, it helps, but if you have a grade one, you win the Kentucky Derby, you're worth about $20 million at a minimum,
Yeah.
So I guess if you're a colt, that's good, but still, other boys are gelding, so it's not going to help his breeding too much.
No, that won't help his chances. When you think back on that win in the Matriarch, that was your very first and still your only grade one win of your long training career. Special moment doing it with your brother, special moment because it's a grade one. But when you think back on that day, what do you remember about watching Stormy Lucy storm down the stretch?
It was like in the fall at Del Mar. Seems like there weren't that many people at the races. The paddock was, we in the paddock, I remember looking around and all the big horses, a lot of big trainers there, which was kind of cool. And I really thought we could win. I'm just kind of like, I think we could win with Stiletto Boy, but I really thought we could win. And I knew she was going to be big odds, because she hadn't won any grade one, and all the other horses were running in grade ones and winning in second. And so, but believe it or not, we ran Stormy Lucy in a grade one earlier in the year, and she actually moved up to the leaders at the eighth pole, and I thought she was going to win, and the rider lost the stick, and she ended up running third and got beat like two lengths. Or no, ran like fourth. I think she ran fourth and got beat like two lengths. And so, I mean, she's a real competitive horse, and she's a real talented horse. And, when you have a really good horse, I mean, you can win races. I mean, things can go your way. And so anyway, when she won, it didn't surprise me that she won. And Kent DeSormo gave her a ride that, if I didn't have him on, it would have been hard to win. He gave her an absolutely perfect ride. He's, a wall of horses, and he just weaved in and out of them and just got up and got up in time. And so it was pretty exciting, but I think the only ones in the winner's circle was my wife and I. And my brother was actually on a plane coming back from Hawaii, I think it was. So he got off the plane and said his phone was blowing up. He said, I knew something happened. And so anyway, he called me as soon as he got landed and told him we won. And actually my wife and I, we actually got out of the winner's circle, got in the car, and we drove to Phoenix. We had a home in Phoenix at the time.
Yeah.
But and actually all the way home, driving, like 5 hours to Phoenix, I don't think my phone ever quit ringing or texting and ringing, and we returned in Texas all the way back. So it was cool.
Yeah, really cool and really special. Will you go back from time to time and watch that race, Ed?
I do, yeah. I've got a few races that I like a lot. That's definitely one of them. One of my favorite ones of all time was a horse called Kiona. I ran her in a 300 grander cowbred race at Santa Anita. and it was a muddy track, and Garrett Gomez was on her. And down the backside, she had to be 30 out of it or 40 out of it. And they turned for home. I mean, it looked like she could run last, you know. And then she started moving. I said, gosh, she's moving a little bit. I hope we can get up for third, you know, or get up for fourth or third. And well, you know, she ended up winning by two. And that was one of my favorite races.
Yeah, those kind, and much like Stormy Lucy, those are races that they stick with you, right? And they're the type of races when those horses come flying at the end. I've owned the first horse I ever owned. He ran in his very first race, and he ran down the hill at Santa Anita, and he came from dead last and came flying at the end. And it's those moments that stay in your head. It's like that with front runners too, but gosh, those ones that close and make up a lot of ground late and give you that thrill they're priceless, aren't they?
Yeah, I've always liked that kind of horse. And the first horse that the first year that I trained, I had a horse called Super Dan. And the day I claimed him, he ran really bad. So I ran him back. And back then, there's no videos, you know, but I used to listen to the radio. You know, they'd call a stretch run after or that night, you know?
Yeah.
And I kept that for a long time. I don't have any more, obviously, but the reason is, though, his name is Super Dan, and he's a route horse. And down the backside, same thing, he looked like Silky Sullivan. He was so far out of it. I mean, he was 15 behind the last horse, and the announcer was saying, and Super Dan is far back. And he just kept saying that every time he'd call the races, and Super Dan is far back. And he got up and won that day. And that was like one of the first years I was training. I went crazy. And I used to be more nervous when I'd run horses when I first started training than I will be on Saturday.
Really?
I won't be that nervous. I'll be a little nervous, but not like that. But I remember when I first started training, I was a wreck every time I ran a horse. And it's like weird. And it was very nervous for me to run like a cheap horse. But you know, like I say, I won't be that nervous on Saturday.
Yeah, I think what makes you nervous is when you bring a horse over that doesn't belong, right? And because you have Stiletto Boy, because you think he has a chance.
That's not as nervous. You know, you're more nervous when you have, like, a horse that should win, you know?
You know
what I mean? Like, and the pressure's on it. I mean, you kind of, that would make you more. I don't get nervous like I used to. But even on every horse that I run now, you know, even the cheap horse now, you get the thrill. It's a thrill when you run, even when they're a cheap horse.
You know, you talk about horses. You mentioned the name Silky Sullivan, and horses that were big closers would come flying late. And we talked earlier about Stiletto Boy, the fact that he could probably be on the lead in the Breeders' Cup Classic if you wanted him to. He has early speed. Is there a difference, Ed, in training a horse that comes from far back and training a horse that has more early speed?
It's the horse. You know, I've always tell people that, for me, just try and get a horse as good as they can be. Don't try to get them as fit as they can. Just try to get them as right as they can. You know, we have to get a horse right. And if they're right, they're going to run, they're going to run where they want. You know, they're going to lay where they want to lay. And if you don't push them, push them to be on the lead or pull them way back, just let the horse relax wherever they're comfortable. I think that's what's best for a horse. And so when those horses are closers, like, it's not because I take them way back there. That's where they're comfortable. And I think that's what all the good riders do. I think they let the horse, just be comfortable. And if they're way back, they're way back. You know, Rosario is one of my favorite riders. And I kind of like started him up there in Northern California. He had already won 1,500 races in the Dominican Republic.
Yeah.
But he couldn't even get a mount, even at Golongate Fields. And so he was kind of breezing all my horses and kind of galloping for me. And And he's like one of my favorite writers of all time. And, you know, he was like breezing and galloping for me. And then he was breezing him good. And I said, yeah, I'll put him on a horse. You know, like nobody, he was trying to get mounts and he wasn't riding anything. And so I put him on a couple and I could tell this guy rode that freaking horse good, you know. And it didn't. I don't think it took a month after that. He was riding everything up there, and he was, you know what happened after that.
Yeah, yeah. He's one of the best riders in the game today. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Kent DeSormo, who I'm assuming will be aboard Stiletto Boy in the Classic, right?
Yes.
Okay. Kent DeSormo is a guy that has experienced his time at the very top of the list. He's as talented as it comes. In recent years, he's gone through his own personal issues off the racetrack. He is now back. You've stuck with him. Talk about that relationship with a guy like Kent DeSormo, Ed.
Honestly, we didn't, you know, he was up in Northern California, too, and he rode some for me. He doesn't ride a lot for me. The thing is, I can't remember how we got on this Stiletto Boy. I had him work the horse one day, and, you know, it was a Del Mar, and he worked it, and he was so excited about that horse, and he'd come back, and he said, where'd you get this horse at? And I said, my brother bought him, and I said he paid $420,000 for him. And he said, that's a steal. He said, this is like a Breeders' Cup horse. That's what he told me.
Wow.
I swear to God. I was like, are you kidding? You know? And so I went to Tony Matos' agent. I said, Kent's like all excited about a horse. He said, he already told me. And Ed, believe me, Kent's not like that. He's not a guy that gets high on horses. I said, really? I said, because I thought maybe, you know, some riders talk like that every horse they get on, you know? And so, you know, that was the first time he worked them. And he told me, he said, this horse is a freak. That's what he told me.
Wow.
So pretty right.
Yeah, so far he's turned out to be exactly right. What do you think he felt underneath him that led him to believe that this horse was that caliber?
He's won, how many Kentucky Derbies? Three, I think?
Or, yeah, three or four.
I mean, he knows. But he says the horse, like, he said, you can't even film switch leads. He said, I think he has a switch, and I looked down, he's already switched, I don't even feel it. And he's got as much speed as I want to give him, and he'll relax, and he's smooth as silk. I mean, he can't say enough good things about him. Every time, he's worked on him every time, but, you know, since he ran the last time, so he likes him.
Yeah, he likes him. His trainer likes him. That's Ed Mosier Jr. His owner, Steve Mosier, Ed's brother, likes him. Everybody likes Stiletto Boy. He just has to get out and do his thing in the Breeders' Cup Classic coming up on Saturday. We're going to take a quick break. When I return, we will continue talking about Ed Mosier's background, his life, his career, and he'll look back on some other moments that will always stand out to him. That's next. This is Trainer Talk on the HRRN, and it's all presented by Basic Tipping.
This November, the sport's brightest stars will be offered for sale at Phasic Tipton. With a sensational catalog featuring no less than 11 champions, Breeders' Cup winners, and Classic winners. Over 30 Grade 1 winners or producers, nearly 50 graded stakes winners or producers, and over 140 selected weanlings. All this in one spectacular session. The world's premier breeding stock event, the Phasic Tipton November Sale, November 9th in Lexington, Kentucky. Where will you be?
Nick Sallusto is your source for proven Grade 1 success at every level. Nick's full-service equine management company includes Thorough Stock Training Center in Morriston, Florida, launching the career of Grade 1 winner Bella Sophia, and Sallusto and Albina Bloodstock, specializing in sales representation, breeding, and private purchases, including Kentucky Derby winner Big Brown, champion Caledonia Road, Grade 1 winners Mind Control, Arklow, Beach Patrol, and Violence, along with undefeated Greatest Stakes winner Cantharos. For more information, visit ThoroughStock.com. That's T-H-O-R-O-S-T-O-C-K.com.
Denali Stud is a perennial leading consigner with three decades of raising and selling Saturday afternoon horses.
Malathon, search results, undefeated fillies, 1-2 down to the wire. Who's going to win it? It's Malathon by a neck.
Idle perfectly timed. Idle gets up under Joel Rosario to win the big cap.
Denali sold Kentucky Oaks winner and leading distaff contender Malathon and fold raised and sold Breeders' Cup Classic contender Idle. Denali Stud, where attention to detail is standard.
Champions are returning to Gulfstream for the championship meet starting December 3rd until April 3rd. Witness the best thoroughbred racing Wednesday through Sunday with weekly stakes races. Returning for its sixth year this January is the 2022 Pegasus World Cup with world-class racing, delectable cuisine, stunning celebrities, and iconic fashion. New for 2022 is the third graded stakes race, the Pegasus Turf for fillies and mares with a $500,000 purse. Tickets go on sale November 8th. Visit PegasusWorldCup.com to learn more and get tickets.
There's a corner of Kentucky in Bourbon County, which some refer to as the Promised Land. There's something in the soil and water that make it something special. So special that some of the world's greatest horsemen have staked their claim in the soil just outside of Paris. Iconic names such as Claiborne, Coolmore, Stone, and Darley grace the fence lines which have housed champions for generations. The name Alapa shines as a tribute to the Gilded Age, sharing the stature and grandeur of its neighbors. Born from the wealth, passion, and imagination of Edward Sims, no expense was spared to fulfill his vision. Sims was in the same league as John Madden and Arthur B. Hancock Sr. as a commercial breeder. The torch has been passed. Welcome to Hill and Dale. At Alapa.
Talking with Dr. Jim Chiappetta of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, do the strips help with EIPH?
Essentially, all horses that work hard are vulnerable to EIPH. As with any elite athlete, we are pushing performance horses to their physiological limits. And when we do, things can break. In this case, blood vessels in the lungs. Nothing stops EIPH. Only two things have been clinically proven to reduce EIPH: Flair strips and Lasix. Alone or with Lasix, Flair strips protect horses from EIPH.
Learn more at flairstrips.com/learn.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Just in behind Receptor, we have Stormy Lucy. O'Lauder is in there as well, about five awesome, and Stella Path, another one in the vanguard. Now here comes Falimbi with a nice run. Falimbi, pink cap, just got to pick a spot to run, then Chatty's on top. Going really, really wide here where She's Not Here. They come for home. It's wide open now. Gender Agenda on the inside. Perfecta down the center of the track. And still continuing a run for Limby the Grey on the outside. But it's Receptor in front now. Late run from Stormy Lucy. Stormy Lucy's flying. Receptor, Stormy Lucy. Stormy Lucy tagged her at the wire. Stormy Lucy to Receptor. For Limby was third and Queen of the Sand running on fourth.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you on this special Breeders' Cup edition of the show, edging closer to the 2021 renewal of the Breeders' Cup World Championships. Trevor Denman had the call of the 2015 Grade 1 Matriarch, Stormy Lucy getting up in the final strides to win that race, giving my special guest, Ed Mosier Jr., the first Grade 1 victory of his training career. Stormy Lucy was 65 to 1 that day under Kent DeSormo. Ed will saddle his first Breeders' Cup starter coming up in the Breeders' Cup Classic on Saturday afternoon, and that will be Stiletto Boy, who figures to be another big price in there. But as you just heard, Ed, Kent DeSormo, they know a thing or two about winning big races at big prices. We'll see if they can pull it off. I'll continue my visit with Ed momentarily right after I remind you that if you missed any portion of this program, all you have to do is head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can hear the entire show at your leisure with our podcast, horseracingradio.net, Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to follow us on social media at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook and Instagram. Ed, I thought I would take you on a little trip down memory lane. You said that that's a race you'll like to go back and watch from time to time. And what was it like listening to it right there?
I've heard it before. I knew what was going to happen.
You can never hear it enough, though, right?
No, it was good.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. Let's talk about the early days of Ed Mosier Jr. Where did the love of horse racing begin for you?
Actually, the first time I went to the racetrack, it was at Long Acres, and I was young, and I went with my grandpa. And back then, I was – actually, I remember I was like a little bored about halfway through. And it was, you know, because I'm young. But one thing I remember Long Acres. I remember the most was the horses coming on with the jockeys and the silks and stuff. I thought that was really, really cool. But that was like maybe once or twice a year. I would do that with my grandpa. And my dad would come sometimes. And when I turned like 18, actually I think we were probably 16, we started going to the races. Our buddies from high school. And we loved going to the races and betting on the horses. And we were going to school in Bellevue, Washington. And on Wednesdays, we would get done at school like at 3 o'clock, drive 3 hours to Portland because they raced at 7 o'clock at night to 11 and then go to the races and then come back and be back for school the next morning. And that's how much we loved horse racing. And we'd go to the races anytime we could. So that was, you know, I loved horse racing that way. The way I got into it, I was going to school at the University of Washington and was literally just looking for a summer job. And, you know, somebody told me I could go out there. Actually, it's Frank Lucarelli. He's now one of my best friends. We went to high school together, but I didn't know him that well in high school, but I knew he had horses, and he's the one that told me, you know, maybe get a job out there at the track. And so I went out there and was grooming in 1975, I think it was.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so I'd go to the University of Washington in the morning. No, I'd go to the track in the morning. Then I'd go to the school. Then I'd come back for feed time in the afternoon. And that was a tough run, but I was doing it. And I just really got into, I just love the mornings and the backside and the horses and bathing them. And, yeah, and then the racing too was exciting to me because I always liked that. And I wasn't planning on making a career out of it. One thing led to another. Actually, the next year I was like an apprentice trainer. I just kind of trained a couple of my own horses, and I was under a trainer called Wally Robinson, and he was telling me things to do and what to do, and that was the next year. And then I went out on my own the end of that summer. I got my trainer's license.
Yeah, that story is so similar to so many trainers that, you know, they think maybe they'll get involved. They grew up as a racing fan, and, you know, maybe I'll do a little bit of work on the track and see how it goes, and then they never leave. I've heard that story, Ed, from so many trainers. It's unbelievable.
You know, once you have it in your blood, I mean, it's exciting. And if people don't own horses or they ever want to, I mean, especially if you're bored and you got money, you should buy racehorses because it's a – you know, if you have it in you to like it. I mean, it gets in your blood and you can get it out. If something happened and they didn't have horse racing, I don't know what I'd do. I mean, I'd get up every single morning, but my whole life I've done that. I mean, I've always gotten up early, go to the racetrack and see my horses.
When you were at that point in your life and you were going to University of Washington and going to the racetrack in the mornings and doing all of those things, were you thinking that, okay, I'll just make some money at the racetrack, and then when I graduate, maybe I'll go do something else in a completely different field? Was that the game plan going in to your education?
No, actually, I was going to University of Boston, and I was only went there 1 year.
Okay.
And so, you know, I was actually burned out at school. And I mean, I kept telling my dad, I said, God, I'm just so tired of school. I mean, I was tired of it, you know, after going through high school and then college. And I mean, I wanted to get out and work. You know, I didn't really care about the racetrack. I just wanted to work, get out and work and do something other than go to school. And so when I went out there, I was not planning on making a living there. In fact, I'd go there, I was making $400 a month. And in the summer, when I got out of school, we'd groom the horses in the morning. That year, his name was Jay Mills, was the trainer, and he had almost all two-year-olds. Every two-year-old was, their last name was like Susie Tyke, Boy Tyke, and Red Tyke, and they were all Tykes. That's what he named all his horses, something Tyke, I don't know why. So, but he had a farm out in Monroe, Washington, which was probably maybe 45 minutes from Long Acres. And so we'd get done in the morning, and then he'd take the whole crew out to his farm, and we'd have to work out there. And I was making $400 a month.
Wow.
Probably working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Wow.
So it was, I mean, you wouldn't think that I would fall in love with doing that, but I like the racing.
Yeah. When you were going to the racetrack with your friends, were you a pretty good handicapper at that point?
I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't think of. I mean, I wasn't making a living doing it. Let's put it that way. But we had a blast. We liked it. You know. Yeah, we were trying to make money. But I mean, I knew. I mean, I could. Yeah, I could read a form. I mean, yeah, I was a good handicapper.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, good.
Everybody's good on their day, right?
Right.
Good days and bad days.
Yeah.
That's the part of being a horse player. I'm visiting with Ed Mosher Jr. here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. So at what point, Ed, did you say, you know what, I'm going to give this a go. This is going to be my profession. I'm going to take out my trainer's license. What led to that decision?
You know, when you're young, you're not really thinking career jobs, you know. And so I was having fun at it, you know. And so I just, you know, I started off with two horses and like my dad owned one of them, and then a friend owned the other one. Actually, his name was Troy Hillis. He was a home builder, and I can't remember how I got that horse, but I had like two horses, and so I was training him, and I can remember, like, I went to Yakima Meadows, and the biggest purse there, whether you're running a maiden race or like an allowance race, the purse was $800.
Oh, wow.
And so, but I was over there and I was rubbing. By the time I got there, I had five horses. I think I claimed a couple and I owned part of one or something. But so I had five horses in Yakima. I was charging $10 a day training. And I was kicking ass. I thought I was making more money than I could ever make. And that's the truth. I'm not kidding. I was killing them. I was going out picking up hay and straw out of the fields in Yakima because they grow it there. And I'd get a bale of hay for 50 cents and a bale of straw for 20 cents. And the gallop boys there were $2, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe one. $2, I think. The gallop boy was $2 a day or $2 a horse. And then I was doing all the grooming, and I was charging $10 a day, and I was killing them. Because you remember, I was making $400 a month before.
Right.
I think I figured in Yakima I was making about $1,000 a month, which was great, right?
Yeah, that's big money.
Back
big then.
Bucks.
Yeah,
yeah,
back then, sure, absolutely. Yeah, especially coming from
$400
a month.
I bought a brand-new truck, a brand-new Chevy truck.
Yep.
I mean, I don't know. I was killing them.
It didn't take you long to get off the ground either, right? Your first starter was your first winner?
It was, yeah. So if you look at my record, the last year, the first year I trained, it was in 1976, I think it was. I think I had like, I've looked at it, it was like 25 starts, you know, four wins or maybe four wins, I think, and 3 seconds and 4/3. My horses earned $3,200.
And now you're going to be running for a $6 million purse on Saturday in the Breeders' Cup Classic.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, they're right there, 1976. I just pulled it up on Equibase. 24 starters, 4 wins, 3 seconds, and 4 thirds, and the total earnings were $3,604.
I was pretty close, wasn't I?
Yeah.
I haven't looked at that for a long time. I knew I was pretty close with the numbers.
Yeah, that's incredible. It's so funny the way this game works, and to see where you are today and in this position. You know, it doesn't come overnight. It's a lot of hard work. Take me through some of the moments, Ed, as you made your way through your career, some of the people that helped you, some of the things that you credit for getting you to where you are today. What are some of those things?
My deal was, like, the first 15 years, I literally groomed most of my horses myself. And, like, maybe in the 80s, I'd hire one person to help me if I had 10 or 12 horses. And my wife was actually, until we had kids, I met her on the racetrack, and she was helping me until we had kids. But, I mean, I worked really, really hard. I mean, I did all the grooming. I brought all the horses over when they ran. And I was a workhorse. And so I did that until about 1990. I think the most horses I ever had was maybe 14 horses, but usually more like about 8 or 10. And then in 1990, Kurt Lanning asked me to take a couple horses to Washington with me. Mm-hmm. And I met him at Golden Gate. I was having a pretty good meet there, and so he just picked, just came and asked me if I wanted to take a couple of horses up there, because he knew I was from Washington, and there were a couple of Washington breds that he'd bought at a yearling sale. So I took him up there, and we did pretty good with the two or three he sent up there to me. And when I came back to Bay Meadows, he asked me if I wanted to take all his horses, and I knew he had a lot of horses in. I said, like how many? And he says, well, we probably got 20 in training over there. And your other trainers had them there at Bay Meadows. And I said, sure. So I went from, 8 or 10 or 12 horses to, I think the first year I had trained for him, I had 35.
Wow.
And he's the one that, was my biggest boost I had back then, because we'd go to the sales and he'd buy like 15 horses every year, 2-year-olds or yearlings. And then he bred a few horses every year, and I trained all those. I actually trained almost all his horses until he quit, quit being an owner just not that many years ago.
Were you still trying to do everything yourself at that point for the most part,
first,
or did you have to hire more help?
I was, when I first did it, and I'll never forget it, started in Bay Meadows, and so, I always mixed up my own feed every single night. I was really meticulous with, I wanted to feed my horses, and then I got, bigger and more things to do, and I mean, I was still trying to, do all the feeding all the time, and I remember Santos Patricio was my first big groom I had. he said, I can do what you're doing. Just let me do it, And I said, well, I know, but I want to make sure you do. He said, I can do it. I said, I'll do it. And I could tell he knew what he was doing, so I let him take over. And I was still trying to do everything. I was even rubbing the horses and stuff, and he'd come in and take the brushes away from me. We got it. You don't have to do this, Yeah, that's seriously, that's the way it was. So it was hard to go from a small barn to big, because it's different, because you go from, handling every horse every single day to really not handling any of them. You're just looking at them .
Yeah, it's a big adjustment.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Ed Mosier Jr. here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Ed, what was the most number of horses you ever had in your career?
At the racetrack, you mean?
Yeah, at the racetrack.
I think I got up to for a short time at Bay Meadows. I want to say I had like 65, maybe.
That's a big number.
Yeah. I've had I've had that even pretty recently. Like in the spring, I always have more because the two-year-olds are coming in. Mm-hmm. And I've never been a real big, when I started off, I was always claiming that's how I got all my horses. But when I got, once I got to be big, almost every horse I got were young horses. And I don't do much claiming. And so they were, you know, mostly all young horses. So every spring, you know, all of a sudden we got 20 more horses in the barn. So always spring was always my biggest number of horses in the barn.
And you now own a horse farm in Galt, California, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. You and your wife, and you're involved in the breeding and raising of the horses. Tell me more about that.
I love the farm. We've got a 40-acre farm in Galt, California, and we've got about 20 resident mares there. I own maybe parts of 5 or 6 of them. And so, you know, some horses we pull there. Some of them, the mares go out to the horse, you know, to the stallion that they're going to be breeding to. They pull there. But I think last year we pulled out about 10 or 12 at our farm. And I was there for quite a few of them. And that's a nice part of the game. I love the farm. I love the young horses. We've built our farm really up from scratch. And we've had it since 2008. And, yeah, it's actually turned out really, really good.
You have a website.
I like getting on my tractor. And I like working at the farm.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I'd be on my tractor on the farm all day long if I could. There's just something about it. You have a website, mosierracing.com. And you have your bio on there. But one of the things it talks about, Ed, is your philosophy. When it comes to working with your clients and working with the horses. And it mentions customer service being a crucial part of what you do and how you've built your business. Tell me more about that approach.
Well, the customer service, you know, if people call me, I always call back. And because I know what it's like when people trying to get hold of you and you can't get hold of them. And I tell you, one person that really schooled me pretty good is that Kurt Lanning. I first started with him, you know, sometimes I didn't call him right back, and boy, he'd get mad at me. I mean, I didn't want to lose that big client, and he taught me how to be to run a business, you know, harder, you know, better. I remember times when I didn't have that many horses, and every once in a while, I remember when I had a farm in Washington, too, for a short time, for 5 years, had a 10-acre farm in Washington. And I remember I'm working hard out there, and like some of my clients would call me, and I wouldn't even call back. They got, I'm busy, I'm not going to call back. And, you know, a couple of owners, I lost them because of that. Yeah, I didn't return their call, and then they get mad at me because I never called them back, and then they get a new trainer. And so you learn as you get older, you gotta take care of your customers.
Yeah,
customers are hard, you know, they're hard to come by, and it's hard to get a good customer.
Yeah, and you've developed such great relationships with those owners that you train for now. I know your brother certainly, but you have other owners that you've trained for pretty much your entire career, right?
Yeah, I'm one of my very first clients, his name was Lee Maxwell. Mm-hmm. And we are still like really good friends. He lives in Phoenix now, and he hasn't had a horse for quite a few years, but he's like, yeah, I trained for him. I'm the only trainer he ever had. And he's a great guy, and yeah, we've still got a good relationship now, even though he doesn't have horses.
How much has the profession of training racehorses changed over the past 4 decades or so, Ed, since you've been involved?
You know, I don't think it changed that much until all these protocols started a few years ago. I think the first, like I would say, maybe the first 35 years, not much changed. And then when, you know, that year at San Diego when they were breaking down, and then, you know, the protocols and this and that. Yeah, that's when it changed the most.
Yeah, I've often wondered when you see the different protocols and the restrictions and all the different things that are in place now and the things that trainers have to go through, why anybody would want to be a horse trainer. So why do you still do it, Ed?
You know, it's a real change, you know, and then, you know, a lot of trainers don't like change. They never have. But it's not that big a deal to me. It really isn't. There's some little paperwork a little bit you have to do and this and that, but it's not that big a deal. And, you know, the problem is it bothers a lot of people when, you know, like a veterinarian tells you you can't do this, you can't do that, and that's what trainers don't like, which we don't, but, you know, I've got some horses that the state vets, you know, they feel uncomfortable letting the horse run, and we end up not running the horse, and we, you know, we retire them or whatever.
Yeah.
And there's some horses that I know are fine, but most of them, it's really not that big a difference if you just, like, roll the flow. It's not that big a deal to me. At first it was. It was like, what are they doing telling us what we can do? But, you know, it's really not that big a deal. You just got to change. You know, it's just a change is all.
Yeah, you just get used to it over time, I guess. And as you said, just kind of roll with it.
It's not as big a deal as people are making out of it. It's, you know, and it seems like the breakdowns are less, so maybe it's a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. That's always a very positive thing. Are any of your children involved in racing, Ed?
No. My daughter, she's a hairdresser, and my son is doing, like, computer work.
Yeah, well, that's okay, too. I'm sure that's okay with you, right? Because racing can be a challenging and a demanding life.
You got to love it or you got to get out of it. Because you've got to love it or it's just too tough of a business.
Yeah, that's so true. Ed Mosier Jr. here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Inside the final furlong here, Ed, I'm down to about 3 minutes left in the program. I can't believe that we've been talking for about an hour here. It has really flown by, and it's been so much fun to hear your story. Let's just get back to Stiletto Boy for a minute. Breeders' Cup Classic on Saturday. He'll probably be a bit of a long shot. Fill in the blank for me. Winning the Breeders' Cup Classic this year would be what?
It would be a good chunk of money for me, for one thing. That's winning the Breeders' Cup would be great. Hey, honestly, it's not going to change my life. I'm going to still be doing the same thing I've been doing. It's really, really exciting. And it actually, we're going to be real excited even this whole week because we're going to go all to the little parties and stuff, my wife and I and my brother. And my brother rented a house down there at Del Mar for the week. And it's a 7-bedroom house there that's right on Encinitas water, on the water in Encinitas.
Yep.
And so we're going to have a really nice week down there and hopefully we can win the Classic.
Yeah, well, all the best to you and to the team. I know it's going to be an enjoyable week, a very busy week, which is why I really appreciate you taking a little time to tell your story with me here today. Before I let you go, Ed, tell me one thing about you that people might not know. What do you like to do outside of racing?
Golf.
Yeah?
Yeah, I like playing golf. Actually, I haven't played that much here just recently, but, you know, my brother and I play in we play in his Invitational. It's a Holly golf course there in Washington every year. And I used to play in the Invitationals with Kurt Lanning, a big owner of mine, every single year. And then I try to play once a week. And golf's great for me. I like it.
Well, Ed, listen, it's been a delight to hear your story. Can't thank you enough for spending time with me here on Trainer Talk this afternoon. All the best in the Breeders' Cup Classic. More importantly, enjoy the week with your friends and with your family. It's going to be very, very memorable.
Thank you.
All right. Ed Mosier Jr. here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig. You can't help but cheer for him, right? What a nice man. Wonderful visit, wonderful story. And somebody who has worked his tail off to get to where he is today. $3,000 in career earnings, in yearly earnings, his first year of training. Now he's running for a cool $6 million coming up on Saturday. My thanks to my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studio. I'm Mike Penna for Ed Mosier. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.